Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is your tech news briefing for Wednesday, June 1st. I'm Zoe Thomas for the Wall Street Journal. This is the second episode of our special series on the private sector's impact on the growing space economy. Yesterday, we talked about the new jobs that could be created as more people travel to space and make use of the resources up there. But if we want to actually set up an economy in space, we'll have to do more than just take short trips to low Earth orbit. We'll need to find ways to live and work up there. We'll need power. And we won't want to bring up all the supplies we need from Earth. We'll want to create them in space. For all of that, we are going to need new materials and new building methods.
There's no gravity that you're dealing with, and so you'll have a structure which is really intended for its environment.
But building those structures in orbit is going to require new technologies and new approaches. On today's episode, we'll hear from the people who've been taking steps to make space manufacturing a reality. That's after the break.
In growing companies, there are two kinds of CFOs, the ones overwhelmed with manual processes, errors, and lack of control of the numbers, and the one who uses NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system, with visibility and control of financials, inventory, HR, planning, and budgeting. NetSuite is everything you need to grow all in one place. The CFOs that get it, get it. The CFOs that don't, don't. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet for a special one-of-a-kind financing offer. netsuite.com/wallstreet.
In a long-awaited moment for scientists and researchers,
liftoff. James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
NASA launched the new James Webb telescope last year to succeed the old Hubble telescope. Eileen Woodward is a science reporter for the Wall Street Journal.
Basically, the James Webb Space Telescope is the largest, most powerful instrument of its type ever built.
Compared to Hubble, the new telescope will be able to see farther into space, allowing astronomers to peer further back into the history of the universe.
It's looking for the earliest stars and other galaxies that came into existence pretty soon after the Big Bang, about 13.8 billion years ago.
But getting it up there was a tricky endeavor.
The reason why this telescope's launch was so complicated is because the James Webb has this colossal 21.5-foot in diameter gold-plated primary mirror. And the problem with having a mirror that big is that it doesn't fit into any rocket nose cone.
To fit the James Webb, scientists had to get creative.
It was very clever. They sort of relied a bit on some origami principles, and what they did is they took that gold-plated mirror and they broke it up into 18 separate segments that they were able to sort of put in a rocket's 18-foot-wide, 56-foot-high nose cone and then send it up into space. And then once it was in space, those 18 separate segments had to unfold and then mesh together, sort of like a giant flower.
It was critically important to get the launch right the first time, because the James Webb needed to be sent far from Earth, making it less accessible if something has to be fixed. The project went 10 times over budget, and it was delayed by 10 years. In fact, there were delays up until the very last minute. But in the end, it all worked out. The reason we're stuck deploying this way is because of what the industry calls the tyranny of launch. Like we just heard, there's only so much spare room in a rocket. Bill Carter is a project manager for the Defense Department agency, DARPA.
Today, we're building really big rockets, and these rockets have a certain lift capability and a certain volume that they can put on orbit, but that's still limited. And so our goal in the space business up until now has been to figure out how we can pack as much as we can into that volume and then have it deploy on orbit flawlessly and then never touch it again.
And even though the team behind the James Webb got it right, a lot of other deployments don't.
I think it's something on the order of 30% of on-orbit satellite failures are really associated with a deployment failure of some kind. So it's a risky proposition to kind of fold something up and get it on orbit.
That's a lot of time, energy, and money wasted.
If we're able to build things on orbit, these large structures, then we can build them without those considerations.
Yep, you heard that right. Scientists want to build things in space, rather than creating them on Earth and assembling them up there. Larger telescopes, more ambitious space stations, even factories that produce goods, all built up in space. That's the goal that Carter and his team at DARPA are aiming for, with a project called NOMAD. That's NOMAD with a 4 in place of the A. DARPA's mission is to support research and development in technology for national security, something it does by working with the private sector, which often benefits from the technology later on. NOMAD is at the start of a multi-year plan to design some pretty big structures in space, including a reflector 100 meters in diameter and an array of solar panels far larger and more precise than what currently exists. The hope is that this project will act as a case study as they work to figure out two things: what materials they can use up in space, and how to put those structures together. First, materials. Building in space could let us do things with materials that we simply can't do on Earth. Here's Carter again.
The space environment is unique. It's, you know, high vacuum. Potentially, temperature in a material can be retained for a long time because it's hard to actually cool down in space. You have to radiate energy. And so it opens up the possibility that we can process materials in a new way. And that may result in new structural materials.
Those new materials would also need to handle the hazards of space. Things like high radiation or bits of space rock hitting it.
There are carbon fiber composites, for instance, that are, instead of using today's fibers, which generally balance stiffness and strength, we can optimize for stiffness.
Carbon fiber, like in a tennis racket, but different from that material, which has some amount of give. Carter says they would have to modify those composites to be less flexible. While some components will be adapted from materials we have on Earth, others will come from materials available in space.
The goal really is very much to do everything on the moon.
Sergio Lucado and his team at the company Teledyne Scientific are part of DARPA's NOMAD project. They're working on developing new ways of using lunar regolith, or what the rest of us might call moon dirt, to create building materials that could be used to make structures on the moon and elsewhere in space. You might remember the first image of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walking on the moon, and the images of the detailed boot prints they left behind. Those prints are still there, in the thick layer of fine powder that covers the moon's surface, almost like snow. But that's not all the moon is made of. If you dig deeper into the crust, particles get thicker, larger. All those layers of dust and sand, dirt and rock, they're composed of elements that Lucado says could be useful in construction.
We really have to figure out, how do we take a scoop of dirt and do something intelligently with it so that we get a material that is strong? For example, if you just take sand and compress it a little bit, you don't get much out of it. But if you heat it, melt it, and then just like with glass, you put all different types of additives into it that will modify the properties of that material a little bit, you end up with something that is a really strong and useful material. And that's really what we're trying to do.
Right now, Teledyne is testing this using synthetic moon dirt in its laboratory. Its scientists are heating and mixing the dirt with other minerals and chemicals to see what characteristics they can bring out and what building materials they can turn it into.
Well, I think that the easiest one would be make a brick. You take sand and you add something to it to kind of form it into a concrete-type structure. But the problem with that is you do require water. I think if you go a little bit further with a lot of other materials that we use, and kind of that's more on the metal side, we go, well, let's melt it. And then now that we melt these things, now we can make different things out of it. We can cast it into fibers. We can cast it into bricks. We can, well, with sand, glass, windows that we all use every day.
But remember, turning raw materials into building blocks is just the first challenge to building in space. The next one is figuring out how to build the foundations for much larger, more complex structures. To do that, Nomad has lined up other partners, companies like Opteris. Opteris' solution is not to create materials in space, but use materials developed on Earth that are more suitable to building in space. It's developed a really, really long tube made of carbon fiber that's flattened out and tightly rolled up so it can be fit into a rocket. When it's unfurled, the tube expands and becomes firm.
Once you start to let them off of that rolled spool, they immediately spring back.
Like those snap bracelets they had in the 90s? They're hard, stiff when they're straight, but roll them around your wrist and they become flexible. Opteris is using that same principle. It wants to send miles worth of these tubes into orbit to use as a lightweight raw material to build structures in space. Eric Pronk, engineering program manager at Opteris, explains.
A real innovation in our approach here is a new material building block that we can manufacture on Earth by the mile, send it into space, and dispense this material, cut it to length, and then join it together to build extremely large truss structures in space.
You've seen truss structures in bridges, the ones where the beams look like spider webs. The tubes will be connected to other tubes with special rivets, creating a shape that Opteris thinks will be optimal for in-orbit building.
Today, what we're pursuing is a tension-based architecture, kind of reminiscent of a bicycle wheel. So we'll have a large perimeter ring surrounding what would be the platform for these apertures, be it a solar array or an antenna. So picture a stiff ring that is then connected with a series of cables internally. Those cables are in tension and pulling on the stiff ring on the outside, and that's where we're generating the structural stability, is from the tension in the spokes of this wheel and then the stiffness of the frame on the outside counteracting the forces.
Opteris hopes that one day other companies will use that giant bicycle wheel for their huge solar sails, large antennas, and telescope lenses.
Yeah, we give the foundation for someone to build the rest of the finished house on, the stable platform to work off of.
Right now, Opteris can make its special tubes up to 30 meters, or about 100 feet in length. But for the Nomad project, it'll need to figure out how to make those a lot longer. Opteris' hope that working on Nomad's far-flung ambitions will one day be a big moneymaker isn't far-fetched. DARPA's programs often result in business opportunities for its partners or other businesses in the private sector. Here's DARPA's Bill Carter again.
Transition is very important to us, transition of technology out of the lab into the world. We have the incredible luxury at DARPA of being able to dream big and dream out many, many years, you know, well beyond what, you know, timelines that a shareholder might expect or even, you know, another agency might expect.
Carter is hoping Nomad will set off a rush of in-orbit building, with implications not just for the development of space. He imagines a factory run by robots, where raw ingredients are turned into finished products and then sent back down to people on Earth.
We've talked about the idea of the lights-off factory filled with robots and, you know, robotic supply of optical fiber ingredients or perhaps semiconductor ingredients. They go through this lights-out factory and then are returned to Earth, say in the capsule that brought the raw ingredients.
Carter sees potential in creating telecommunications fibers that are 10 times faster and maybe even cost one-tenth of the price to produce. And a future where factories run entirely without humans produce more efficient microchips and pharmaceutical drugs in zero gravity where materials of different weights are easier to mix. If this vision of a new space supply chain does come to fruition, Carter believes it could kick the space economy into high gear. But questions remain about who's going to regulate that economy. What rules will exist about mining materials like moon dirt for manufacturing? Or how to protect finished products before they head back down to Earth? And as this space economy is built, who's in charge? We'll look into this question on tomorrow's episode of Tech News Briefing. Thanks for joining us for this special series of Tech News Briefing. This episode was written and reported by myself and producer Julie Chang. Jess Fenton is our sound engineer. We had additional editorial support from Eileen Woodward and David Freeman. Our supervising producer is Chris Zinsley. Our executive producer is Kateri Yoakum. And I'm Zoe Thomas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.